Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2006. Our session today is titled The Road to Emmaus and Other Escape Routes. Our presenter is Peter Holmer, session number HOP 2006-2. Let's listen in.
Good morning. Just about getting ready to go here. There are some Bibles here if you need one. I've asked Dick to lead us in prayer. Shall we pray?
Oh, dear Lord, we thank you for a new day, for the beauty of your creation, for new friends, for new brothers and sisters in Christ. We thank you that we can gather in a place like this to share fellowship, to share our lives, to share ministry. I would ask that you would be with Peter this morning as he leads our discussion, that you would be with all of us, that we might hear your word, and more than that, that we might be empowered to live your word. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you. Theme of this Bible study this week is the Christian big deal, the resurrection. For those of you joining us, we're going to take a look at some resurrection narratives, cognizant of some statements like Yaroslav Pelikan's that in view of believing in the resurrection, nothing else matters. And if there is no resurrection, nothing else matters. And to recall that there's really not a word of the New Testament that's written until after the resurrection. And I became interested in this topic in the Easter season this year and just found all kinds of Easter. I enjoyed everything I was reading about Easter. And gee, it's a short season, and indeed it would be fun to spend some time studying these texts, not in the Easter season. So today's text is The Road to Emmaus. And so if you turn to Luke chapter 24, verse 13. It's Easter evening. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation which you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. And one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it's now the third day since this happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. And they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he interpreted to them all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further. But they constrained him, saying, 'Stay with us, for for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent. So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. And they found the 11 gathered together and those who were with them, who said, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." Then they told what happened on the road and how he was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. Stop there. That's a lot. And I think the easiest way is just to dive right in and take some stops where there's some confusion and or questions, and if you've got anything, wave wildly. You're all in profile to me against the light, so I'm not going to see you. I won't even, you ask the tough questions, I won't know who's asking it. We have two walking the road from Jerusalem, and they're in conversation about the weekend. But I'd like to start with verse 15. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So Jesus shows up and their eyes are kept from recognizing him. Anybody got any ideas why and what that means? Who was keeping who from recognizing and why, and what was going on here?
I think they were themselves blinded, because after all, he's dead. Yeah. No one comes back to life. So how would he be there?
He could have very well looked exactly like he did, but it didn't occur to them. So the limitation was in from their point of view. The other possibility might be what?
He didn't come back in the form that they expected.
Right, that their eyes were kept from recognizing him because his physical appearance was different than before. On one hand, it's the intention and plan of God, and on the other hand, it's kind of the limitations of the... So, you know, let's read some more and see how that fills out with both those possibilities. And maybe there's a third, but there's two at least we want.
The woman at the tomb didn't recognize him immediately either. She thought he was the gardener.
Right.
It says.
Okay, that's right. So, yeah, there is some other evidence that he... how?
There's a variant within your one about physical appearance.
Yeah.
There's at least two ways of thinking about how the physical appearance might be different. And one of the ones is that the last time they had seen him physically was as a crucified person on the cross, and that he may not have had any look like a person who had been crucified on the cross. May not have all of that attributes to him as one of the physical differences.
Yeah, all well and fine. Yeah, and so... Either he looked a lot like Jesus, or maybe he was in a different form. Let's see if some of the other dialogue reveals what might fit better than another. And Jesus said to them, "What is this conversation which you are holding with each other as you walk?" Do you think Jesus knew? Did he? So that was a rhetorical question, wasn't it? He knew. He knew where they were at, and that question was for their benefit, not his, correct? It was an invitation, and they stood still looking sad. Then one of them named Cleopas answered him. And this is comic. "Are you the only one?" He should laugh out loud. "Are you the only one that doesn't know what happened in Jerusalem?" That's hysterical. If Shakespeare were writing this, we'd be laughing. It really is. It's kind of absurd for them and it kind of makes these disciples look like the Three Stooges.
Are you the only one?
Yeah.
Well, it may be an indication of their emotional state. I mean, their inability to recognize him initially is because they may have been so focused on their own grieving or emotion, and the silly statement may also be a reflection of that state.
That's a good observation. Yeah.
Then he reinforced by asking.
Okay.
So it's like.
Yeah. No, it's a good observation, but you could look at this and kind of see them as being very silly, but there is an explanation. And he said, what things? Once again, he absolutely knows, but he wants to see where they're coming. And they give a pretty good report concerning Jesus of Nazareth. And what do they believe about him? A prophet, mighty in word before God and all the people. And they're blaming the chief priests and rulers who delivered him up to be condemned to death. Who are they blaming for the crucifixion? Pilate or the chief priests?
Chief priests.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
And
rulers.
Which could include Pilate.
It could, right. It could be both. But here's the line that just really shows their disappointment. 21. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. And obviously what? Their hopes have been dashed. And they're sad, and perhaps in such grief or pain that they don't even recognize Jesus. Their hopes are dashed. Can you think of any other times and experiences where, in literature or your own life, where that kind of, but we had hoped this would happen. What is that about, when hopes are dashed? Can you think of any?
Most like when the football team loses. That's what I thought of. And our team is lost. I mean, we're not going to have the king. Not going to lead Israel out.
Okay. We had hoped.
We had hoped.
We had hoped. Okay, well, go with that image for a while. And if your team had won,
we would have ruled.
We would have been able to go to Wisconsin and say, well, the Bears did it. Yeah. If we win any games in Chicago, we Flatlanders are going to go up and tell their Green Bay Packers that it was a great season.
Peter, probably the best image that comes to mind with mine is I went to Michigan and, there's 111,000 people and we play Ohio State. We beat Ohio State that year, and we walked across the field, and there was a man and his wife just sobbing on the 50-yard line with Buckeye shirts on.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Well, and a little more serious, when your hopes are really dashed because you lose someone you love, like they have,
right.
Thank you.
Then you realize, it takes a while, but you realize you have to get a different life. And so these apostles who had been following Jesus, thinking he was the one, now what do we do?
You have to get a different life. You are conceiving of your future in a different way. On the football image, the party's going to be a lot of fun if you win. You're anticipating having won Michigan State or Michigan game all year. You got bragging rights, if you will. But the party or the life you thought you'd have, that you'd envision, doesn't happen. And in the case of losing someone you love, you're looking forward to retirement, you're looking forward to any number of things, and all of a sudden, what you had envisioned. What had they envisioned?
Your analogy yesterday of putting our weight behind a political candidate, I think, is holds a little bit more traction here, because they were tied up in the idea of a messianic vision, which was a political and religious vision combined. And so I think the sense of getting behind a candidate and putting all your hopes and dreams into an image of what a new reign or rule would be is maybe a little more apt than an analogy.
Okay. And you know, what do you do with those old campaign posters when you lose? And we had hope.
I still want to counter that.
But
there were some people who had felt love for the first time in their life, and it had been transformed to the nature of their existence, and they had lost the person that loved them.
As a parent, like a love as a parent, right? Is that what you mean?
Well,
can be anybody that
agape love, real sense of love and acceptance and in being embraced and belonging, that kind of love.
Okay.
Transforming love. But in the text here, he was the one to redeem Israel. I would go with the political hope one. I don't hear them saying, oh, my best friend's gone and I'll never see Jesus again and hear his good stories or see him heal. Do you get that? Or do you get he was the one to redeem Israel? What?
Well, going along with the political situation, they were kind of, under the thumb of Rome. You know, they were almost in slavery to Rome. They were hoping to get out of that.
But it's a little incongruous to me that, in view of what we said and what he just said and what we said yesterday, that they would talk to a stranger about and make a declaration. We thought he was going to be. They declared a discipleship to a stranger. In political times, it ain't too good.
Risky thing to do.
But these people were distraught. Mm-hmm. They probably weren't as wary as.
And we're talking about it. And Jesus did push the issue. He really does show up. He joins and he says what things and what's going on here. And they're definitely impassioned about this.
I think they have a sense of the world could have been different. And maybe the world for them was Israel. But you know, it could have been different. And now it's not good. It's going to be the same old stuff. And I think they're grieving.
Okay. All right, let's just go on a second here. Exactly. And now what happens next? Yes, and besides all this, the fact that our hopes have been dashed, it's now the third day. More of them, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body, and they came back saying that he'd even seen a vision who said he was alive. Do they believe this?
Not really.
No. I sent some guys. Yeah.
They have as much evidence as anybody else has.
Women talking.
Well, all that's women talking, right? And some of those who were with us went to the tomb even and found it just as the woman had said, but him they did not see. They have an empty tomb. Now, according to Mark, this is all the evidence you get, right? Mm-hmm. So these people on the road to Emmaus have all the evidence Mark gave his readers, right? Except one thing. There was a promise there. Go to Galilee and you'll see him, right? But they are discounting the good news, really, aren't they? They're kind of like, don't try to make me feel better, right? And the real bomb, I think, happens. How does Jesus deal with these grieving people in pain and disconsolate? I feel your pain. What does he say? He didn't take CPE, did he? Oh, foolish man!
Well, that's kind of surprising, isn't it?
They're also unbelievers.
Yeah. Oh, foolish men and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Wow. He's not very kind, is he?
He was testing their faith and saying, how much more do you need?
Yeah. Now, he doesn't leave them there. But I think it's important. Does he really give them much empathy or sympathy for their dashed hopes?
No.
Why? Let's read a little further. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them all the scriptures and the things concerning himself. And the subject of what?
The prophecies.
Which talk about necessary of
dying and rising.
Suffering. The necessity of suffering. What do you think these folks had envisioned as the redemption of Israel?
Winning the football game.
Winning. Winning. And seeing the Romans get on their ships and leave, and a new administration, and chicken in every pot. Right?
Led by the Messiah.
Led by the Messiah.
They've been waiting for the Messiah.
The Messiah was going to be Barack Obama in spades. Okay? God bless him. He's from Illinois.
Hey, Peter.
What?
Why, I would have thought that Luke would have expanded on that. I mean, that here's all this wealth of information coming from Jesus, but it's reduced to one verse.
Oh, in terms of going to those scriptures?
Yeah.
Beginning with Moses and all the prophets?
Well, and he interpreted them.
All the things concerning himself. You'd kind of like to hear that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
That's a good observation.
I have a different observation.
Okay, all right.
I think the reason Jesus said, oh, foolish men, is because it's like being a mom, and you tell your kids stuff over and over and over, and they don't listen, and they do the dumb things. And he was saying, listen, I just spent 3 years telling you this. Here it is again.
Here it is again.
There it is again.
And they, you just didn't get it. It's not about winning the game. That's not what it's about. My first call, Pastor Ted Youngquist said a phrase that I attribute to him. He said, "You will never be disillusioned if you are under no illusion." And I like that. You will never be disillusioned if you're living under no illusions. What illusion are these guys living under? They're disillusioned, obviously, right? They lived under the illusion that the purpose of the Messiah was this happy kingdom of winning in Romans and
A new political order.
A new political order and of glory. Certainly not suffering. That, if anything, if you look back at what they said, hey, Jesus was a prophet, great in word, and then he got killed by the rulers. That, and boy, if we had the right rulers, that never would have happened, implied. So, moving right along. I just want to pause here for a second. You think their discussion would have taken them anywhere without Jesus? I want to read Frederick Buechner quote that
maybe to a bar.
Pardon me?
Maybe it would have taken them to a bar.
Oh, yeah, okay. You're clairvoyant.
Why did they want to go to Amsterdam?
Emmaus. Well, because Emmaus isn't a place. Buechner writes, you can't find it on MapQuest. Emmaus is a place that we go in order to escape. A bar, a movie, wherever it is, we throw up our hands and say, let the whole damn thing go hang. It makes no difference anyway. Emmaus may be buying a new suit, or a new car, or smoking more cigarettes than you really want, or reading a second-rate novel, or even writing one. Emmaus may be going to church on Sunday. Emmaus is whatever we do or wherever we go to make ourselves forget that the world holds nothing sacred, that even the wisest and bravest and loveliest decay and die, that even the noblest ideas that people have, ideas about love and freedom and justice, have always in time been twisted out of shape by selfish people for selfish ends. Emmaus is a place we go in order to forget and escape. And when I read that, it just went. And why do people want to escape, according to Buechner? Because of their disillusionment about the lack of meaning. And going back to yesterday, the loss of hope that there's justice in the world and that the resurrection of a politically executed prisoner is really to strike a blow against the system of oppression that condemned him and to raise the idea that hope is always possible and that indeed that is a universal hope that Christ brings. But does Buechner have our culture nailed here? What were some of his examples?
No. MapQuest.
Yeah. Well, what do people do? Going to Emmaus could be what? What are some of the things he listed?
Bars, cigarettes,
the movie,
movies,
church,
shopping.
Shopping, yeah. Buying a new car, a new suit. Remember the glass menagerie? What did Tom Wingfield do? Every time you get frustrated with Amanda. I'm going to the movies. Nobody can go to the movies that much. Why do you go there? And if you were in the lift last night, there was a great song about my life is, if my life were a movie. Ask somebody in the kitchen to sing it for you. It's great. The place we go to escape and forget what do people, and why are we such a consumer society? Because we bought this vision that somehow satisfaction is going to come, that the meaning and the wholeness that we seek can be filled with acquisition of stuff.
An external object, not something.
And in fact, I think it's sad. I don't think most people are really too. They're not invested in much as how the politics runs, but it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy, stupid. Right? Just and as long as the consumer keeps spending, you know, the stock market will go up. That we buy things to fill this, but is that really a road to Emmaus kind of event, place to go to escape?
That we crave diversion from the reality that we're living with. We crave being taken out of that. Entertainment is. You know, even in worship these days, people want entertainment. We talk about entertainment worship to kind of move you into another reality, another world, I guess. Another.
Well, why was church on that list?
Going to worship, he said. One of the.
Yeah. Going to worship could be running away from the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is church a place we go to remember or forget?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Church a place we go to remember or forget. It's a sanctuary.
Yeah.
Right?
Meaning shelter.
Shelter.
Safe place.
Safe place. And it's one of the few unchangeable things in my life, in this rapidly changing thing. And how dare you bring a new hymnal in here? I don't want to be challenged. I want to be comforted. And I want to forget just how fast-paced and changing the world is. And give me a sanctuary. I want to go to just, you know, be safe for a while. And there's something to that. But on the other hand, it can be an escape from a world that doesn't make sense and that I'm afraid, that I'm running from. Interesting to me that I just wanted to put this Emmaus event in kind of a modern context as we go on here.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Are we to assume that these disciples had not gone to Jerusalem back on their own to find out really? I mean, that they just heard by word of mouth?
Well, it seems to me they had heard, it's later in the day.
Right.
And so they've heard the reports of the empty tomb and people checked it out, so they'd heard someone else went and saw, didn't see, they saw the empty tomb.
But so they themselves did not check it out.
They didn't, you know, so if it's 7 miles, that's a good 2-3 hour hike. They might have left after lunch. And so they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." Why did they ask him to stay?
It was the custom of the day to invite strangers in, for one thing, but they also felt the need to be with them more.
They wanted more information. They liked what they heard.
Middle East hospitality?
I think it can be both. They're obviously, he had diverted them from their disillusionment. Even as he scolded them, he kind of shown them a new way to yeah.
But maybe they took comfort in the scriptures that he was interpreting, and he was bringing them respite from this grief. He
said their hearts were burning.
There's burning bushes everywhere, but we don't have the eyes to see them. And Jesus, he interpreted the scriptures in such a way as the message began to ring true. And then later on, their hearts were burning. So they did want more of that. And yes, it would have been hospitable for them to invite him to stay. And there's that great evening hymn that's kind of taken off this. "Abide with me, fast falls the evening time." When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. Boy, we've heard that before. Right? And their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" Okay. Why are those words so familiar? He broke the bread and blessed it and gave it. I'll tell you a story. Back in 1973, Nixon, in 73, I was the first year in seminary and in New Haven, and I went to a concert at Woolsey Hall of the Mahavishnu Orchestra, John McLaughlin, And at the end of this concert, about 10:30, this impassioned young man came up on the step and said, "We've got these buses on the village green, and we're going down to Washington to protest the inauguration of Richard Nixon. And anybody that wants to go, for like 10 bucks, you can ride down to Washington and back." So Wes Perkins and I were sitting there. And he said, "Well, let's go." And so we ran, and we got backpacks and some warm clothes, and we got on the bus, and we rode all night down to the Washington Mall, and it was like 42 degrees and cloudy. And on every street corner in Washington was a soldier or a policeman. But the mall was just, started at the Lincoln Memorial. There were 75, 100,000 people that were there from all over the place. And then the parade up Pennsylvania Avenue to the monument, and then speeches, and I remember one was by Bella Abza. But it was kind of a raw day, and at the end of all, you know, the inauguration was going on. And so Wes and I were walking across the park looking for our bus. And we had stopped in some Walgreens and bought a bottle of cheap wine to drink on the bus. As we're walking through the park with our heads down in the wind, we hear this voice, "You hungry?" And we don't see anybody. "Are you hungry?" And we look, and there's these bushes, heavy bushes, and there's this guy sitting underneath there. So we stop, and we walk over there, and we kind of go down, and he says, he's got this big hunk of bread and cheese. I said, "Yeah, we're hungry." Well, you know, he was a seminarian from Pittsburgh. And we pull out our bottle of wine, and we drink, and
you had your last supper.
And there was Jesus at the end of a real discouraging day. The last thing, you know, Kyle, you hit your head. "Hello! Hello. Made known, I will be made known to you in the breaking of the bread." I don't know if that guy was for real. But you know, Pittsburgh's a real place. But when I read this story, I certainly wasn't looking forward to four more years, and the Vietnam War was still raging, and I think one of the reasons I went to Washington was just to shake my fist at it. But at the end of the day, I didn't feel like much had changed. And yet, the food for the journey was there. And I got on the bus and went back to seminary. Here I am.
It occurs to me that in both your example, and they're not wanting him to leave, but there's kind of a flavoring of denial, of the process of denial that we all have. In response to death, in response to departure, giving up. Why would you get on a bus and go down to hear someone say something about Nixon? It's kind of a denial. He's not my president. No. This didn't happen. I would have felt that way. I did feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's only something we can do. That's an interesting comment. The folly of youth, perhaps, some foolish men. But I don't know. I don't want to get too sidetracked. But I guess I want to say, at least when it all ends, I could say I didn't go quietly. It was an integrity issue. So. But, you know, bringing that to the present, Jesus being made known, I mean, Luke knew what he was doing, didn't he? You think, when he wrote this, by now the church has been in business for a while, and the supper had been commanded and celebrated. You know, remember me in the breaking of the bread. Do this in remembrance of me. I mean, that was known by heart by the community to which this text was written. And it is the distinctive thing of Christian worship. I remember Walt Bowman said, he's the one that convinced me that we should have communion every week. And he proposed this this scene. You're in Karachi, Pakistan, at the Hilton, and they say there's worship today. In ballroom A are the Jews, and B are the Muslims, and C are the Christians. But they got signs in Pakistani, and you peek through the windows to see where the Christians are, and you look in, everybody's praying, and everybody's got the book. And there's some exhortation going on, and finally you find the right place. How? The table's set.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you go in, and it's all in Pakistani. And when it comes time to celebrate, you know what to do?
Yeah.
And you go, and you open your hands, and anybody know Pakistani? They say, and you know exactly what they say, right? The universality is just, to this day, cuts through it all. But and coincidence, whatever, that was Jesus' plan. And so, do you think Luke knew that when he wrote this? This is the community's signature sign to this day. So do you think there's an invitation there? What kind of invitation?
Come share the supper. Come share hospitality.
Come share a part of me.
Part of me. And when you are disillusioned, and when you are lost and alone, and when you think nice guys always finish last, and when your future has been totally dashed and you can't imagine a life, the new one before, come to the meal and I will be made known to you in the breaking of the bread. In a couple dimensions, and what are they? Well, you're Lutherans. What ways? Transcendently, right? But also in the community,
yeah.
Right? Come to the table. One of the great things in grief is when you don't know how to your phone number anymore, literally, is to do the familiar and to go to the table and to the community and to the family that one goes to. Or even in a strange town or a strange place, to go to the meal, which speaks the same language, hopefully, to everyone. But how is the resurrection going to be known in our time? I think Luke is laying out at least one dimension here, big time. But the other one is, you know, I want to go back to the whole suffering thing. The theology of victory versus the theology of the cross is something that he's pointing to here. To the point that their vision of what the kingdom was supposed to look like was incorrect. And what alternate vision do you think Jesus is offering? What do you think he was pulling out of those scriptures?
The Old Testament prophecies.
Moses and the prophets concerning himself.
Suffering servant. image, probably. Bonhoeffer somewhere says, writes, who is a Christian? And his answer is, a Christian is one who joins God in the suffering of the world. That's who a Christian is. One who goes with God into the suffering of the world. So he probably was talking about the suffering servant.
Mm-hmm. The faithful remnant. I want to read the last quote from this article. They quoted deep in here. But perhaps would be helpful to this discussion. Ready or not, the risen Jesus leads us headfirst into change, into untiring engagements against those powers that market Emmaus as the most desired destination on earth. What does that mean? Marketing Emmaus as the most desired destination on earth. What does that mean?
Is that still from Buechner?
Well, it's in response to his article. Yeah, same article. The place to get away and not remember, to be.
It's a, for lack of a better term, a theology of escapism.
Yeah. This theology of escapism and consumerism.
Yeah.
I think.
I think it's escapism that doesn't know it's escape. I mean, I think that's the only story our culture knows to tell. There's not, especially now that Christendom's dead. There's not the imagination to know there's another. A journey that goes another direction.
Oh, please say a lot more about that. What do you think?
I think it's a radical story that Jesus tells. It's fundamentally different from the militarism and the materialism that our society, it's the myth of our society in that it controls us and we don't even know it. And we can't imagine there's any other way. And that's the power of the prophets. You know, I mean, Beta, Reuben and all those guys. It's the profound, sacred imagination. Know there's something other. It's uncreated yet. There's we can only see death. We can see life beyond it. So.
And not to be seduced, if you will,
right.
by the enticements of Emmaus as the most desired destination. Own your own McMansion. Make your next vacation more exotic and your next car slicker than the last one.
I think it's like the journey too reminds me of Walker Percy, that novel, The Moviegoer. I mean, the worst thing in the ailment of our culture is to not even know that there's a journey to be had. At least these guys were on the journey. Our culture didn't even tell that story anymore.
That's right.
You know, I'd like to put just a little different spin on this,
yeah.
If I could, because I think that's the beauty of the gospel,
okay.
that the metaphor and the richness of it. Everything we've said is so true of a Buechner fan, the whole thing of Emmaus, but if you look at it from a slightly different perspective, here are a couple of individuals whose entire life has been crashed, dashed. And so they head off to this place, Emmaus, and I remember reading that Emmaus really was a resort town. And so here was a chance for them to realize there's nothing more we can do here. We've got to go sort this out. We've got to figure out what's next. If you look at it in that way, going to in Emmaus, going to a holden village, going on the journey somewhere else to make sense and sort all this out, puts a little different perspective on it. And so on one hand, I'm ready to bash these two guys. On the other hand, I'm seeing, yeah, sometimes you've got to get away from where you are. And even if you're in the midst of grief, despair, and I know I've done it, you just got to get away from there, and you go on the journey, adventure, and who do you meet along the way? In just a couple of days that I've been here, I've met some remarkable people, you know, that, you know, the face of Christ is appearing to me in some of you already. And so there's a kind of a different flip side spin to this we can also look at it a little differently. And maybe that Emmaus becomes a place, we may never get there. Maybe on the journey, you know, we're intercepted and we're turned around to go back. But maybe we get there and maybe it becomes a place where we find community, where the bread is broken, and we become restored, renewed, and that leads us to go further on.
And find meaning.
And find meaning.
And find meaning, yeah.
I that's a legitimate thing, but I guess the next thing in my notes is who's looking for who? who they were on a journey in Emmaus. Do we journey after God, or is God looking for us? And what does this story say?
God finds us.
God finds us. But you know, it could be on the road to Emmaus, it could be at Holden, I acknowledge that. And, mm-hmm. And yet, he breaks into their discussion. He breaks into their illusions, and then he is invited into their home finally, or their place. But the good news here is not that Jesus is after us foolish people who don't always get it right. That he is in search of us to. Say, hey, this is the way it is. There, use your imagination. Conceive a different future. And what you thought was dead is not dead. There is another way to look at this. And suffering, the pain and suffering you're going through is really not a negation of the fact that you may be on the right path. We live in a culture that has no tolerance for pain or disappointment. One of the reasons for the high suicide rate among young people is they don't know how to tolerate a disappointment. And so I've heard, or a loss. And my gosh, we drug ourselves to death to have a pain-free life. And is that Jesus? Question.
I think that it's a far oversimplification to view suicide or retreat into drugs as just an escape from pain. I think it's a much more complex issue than that. And I think that, in my perspective, part of this is a lack of communication and caring rather than just an escape from pain. It's a lack of community.
How's that not pain?
Huh?
How is that not pain? A lack of community.
It is both pain and support. I think it is both pain and support. I would not classify it as either one particularly. It is almost an ingredient of life.
Other comments, questions? We got 5 minutes left. Yes.
I want you to touch on what you said at the beginning, which was very compelling about verse 16, you know, where their eyes were kept from recognizing him and then jumped to what
okay.
We just read 31. Can we talk a little bit about when their eyes were opened and they recognized him? And who the agent is there or not? Or
yeah.
What's this all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, to go. Their eyes are opened when Jesus is revealed in the breaking of the bread. Once again, looking through their eyes and our eyes, I'm going to propose that Jesus was in a different form. That
physically
looked different. I'm going to propose that is what I think. To start that discussion. because, you know, anybody see the movie What Dreams May Come Ever with Robin Williams?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the great things about that movie is when he meets his children in heaven, they're in a totally different form. And they are he recognizes them by their substance and character, not by their physical appearance.
By actions they do?
By actions they do. And one of the reasons that is given by the guide is that you have preconceived notions of what these kids are, and you've got to get beyond that. If you just saw them as they are, you'd miss who they become. And there's some of what they were, but there's more than that. So you just can't go running your son as your son. And, you know, it's a wonderful movie, except for the last
What's
two.
The title?
What Dreams May Come. It really is thought-provoking, you know, except for the last 1 minute. But
and I like that because it gets to at least part of the discussion that I think I'm hungry for is the why. Like whether he was in a different form or whether there was some sort of a spiritual mask in front of their eyes. The question I think for the text, because the text lifts it out with those verses, they're kind of screaming at me, why? Why are they kept from? What's different about this?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to deal with something that I read somewhere, is that the Jews had an idea that people that had unmerited suffering, especially people that had been persecuted by a domination system and brutally treated, that their bodies would be resurrected without the brutality impact on it. That somehow unmerited suffering could be redemptive. And if these people were seeing that in Jesus, that he didn't merit the suffering that he went through, and that the victory had come in that sense, in the spiritual sense, that it would be a huge impact on them, just from the cultural context that they were coming out of, that it is true that unmerited suffering is redemptive.
Well, I would, who's this text for? I would say that's important. This text is for
the believing community
and those yet to believe,
yeah.
Correct?
Who do not get to see Jesus.
Who don't know what Jesus looks like anyway.
Right.
Who is always going to be a stranger. So you should be, that entertaining angels unawares go ahead.
Well, I'd like to propose a question back to the why.
Yeah.
Are they prevented from seeing him? What's the difference for us today? We don't get to see, and yet we're asked to believe, and blessed are the children that just believe because somebody told them. You know, that's what faith's all about. So what's different from them from us today?
And I guess, okay, I think that's what I'm suggesting here is that that we do not, and that perhaps a Jesus who just comes in a stretch limo and, you know, with a lot of bling. Here I am. You know, the belief and relationship to that Christ there's something about the discovery of the Christ, which is a journey, which is a relationship, which is an unfolding, which is a mystery, which is a process, that Jesus is known to us. There's no fast track to that, that belief. And it comes through the scriptures, and it comes through the meal, and it comes through a process. Now, we didn't get to the great end part. We got 1 minute. What do they do?
They left that evening to go back to Jerusalem.
They ran there. There's a pretty happy ending. They certainly are energized and when they get there, they find that the other community members have equally and then the next thing in the text is Jesus appears amongst them. How does he appear then? Oh, I guess we'll have to talk about it tomorrow. Thank you.